consciousness, on an understanding of why orders must be obeyed. It takes time to diffuse this, but it also takes time to drill a man into an automaton on the barrack square. The journalists who sneered at the militia system seldom remembered that the militias had to hold the line while the popular army was training in the rear. And it is a tribute to the strength of revolutionary discipline that the militias stayed in the field at all. For until about June 1937 there was nothing to keep them there, except class loyalty. Individual deserters could be shot, were shot occasionally. But if 1,000 men had decided to walk out of the line together, there was no force to stop them. A conscript army in the same circumstances, with its battle police removed, would have melted away. Yet the militias held the line, though God knows they won very few victories, and even individual desertions were not common. In 4 or 5 months in the POUM militia, I only heard of 4 men deserting, and 2 of those were fairly certainly spies who had enlisted to obtain information. At the beginning, the apparent chaos, the general lack of training, the fact that you often had to argue for 5 minutes before you could get an order obeyed appalled and infuriated me. I had British Army ideas, and certainly the Spanish militias were very unlike the British Army. But considering the circumstances, they were better troops than one had any right to expect. Meanwhile, firewood. Always firewood. Throughout that period, there is probably no entry in my diary that does not mention firewood, or rather the lack of it. We were between 2,000 and 3,000 feet above sea level. It was midwinter, and the cold was unspeakable. The temperature was not exceptionally low. On many nights it did not even freeze, and the wintry sun often shone for an hour in the middle of the day. But even if it was not really cold, I assure you that it seemed so. Sometimes there were shrieking winds that tore your cap off and twisted your hair in all directions. Sometimes there were mists that poured into the trench like a liquid and seemed to penetrate your bones. Frequently it rained, and even a quarter of an hour's rain was enough to make conditions intolerable. The thin skin of earth over the limestone turned promptly into a slippery grease, and as you were always walking on a slope, it was impossible to keep your footing. On dark nights, I have often fallen 6 times in 20 yards, and this was dangerous, because it meant that the lock of one's rifle became jammed with mud. For days together, clothes, boots, blankets, and rifles were more or less coated with mud. I had brought as many thick clothes as I could carry, but many of the men were terribly underclad. For the whole garrison, about 100 men, there were only 12 greatcoats, which had to be handed from sentry to sentry, and most of the men had only 1 blanket. One icy night, I made a list in my diary of the clothes I was wearing. It is of some interest as showing the amount of clothes the human body can carry. I was wearing a thick vest and pants, a flannel shirt, 2 pullovers, a woolen jacket, a pigskin jacket, corduroy breeches, puttees, thick socks, boots, a stout trench coat, a muffler, lined leather gloves, and a woolen cap. Nevertheless, I was shivering like a jelly. But I admit, I am unusually sensitive to cold. Firewood was the one thing that really mattered. The point about the firewood was that there was practically no firewood to be had. Our miserable mountain had not even at its best much vegetation, and for months it had been ranged over by freezing militiamen, with the result that everything thicker than one's finger had long since been burnt. When we were not eating, sleeping, on guard or on fatigue duty, we were in the valley behind the position, scrounging for fuel. All my memories of that time are memories of scrambling up and down the almost perpendicular slopes, over the jagged limestone that knocked one's boots to pieces, pouncing eagerly on tiny twigs of wood. Three people searching for a couple of hours could collect enough fuel to keep the dugout fire alight for about an hour. The eagerness of our search for firewood turned us all into botanists. We classified according to their burning qualities every plant that grew on the mountainside. The various heaths and grasses that were good to start a fire with, but burnt out in a few minutes. The wild rosemary and the tiny whin bushes that would burn when the fire was well alight. The stunted oak tree, smaller than a gooseberry bush, that was practically unburnable. There was a kind of dried-up reed that was very good for starting fires with, but these grew only on the hilltop to the left of the position, and you had to go under fire to get them. If the fascist machine gunners saw you, they gave you a drum of ammunition all to yourself. Generally, their aim was high, and the bullets sang overhead like birds, but sometimes they crackled and chipped the limestone uncomfortably close, whereupon you flung yourself on your face. You went on gathering reeds, however. Nothing mattered in comparison with firewood. Beside the cold, the other discomforts seemed petty. Of course, all of us were permanently dirty. Our water, like our food, came on muleback from Alcubierre, and each man's share worked out at about a quart a day. It was beastly water, hardly more transparent than milk. Theoretically, it was for drinking only, but I always stole a pannikinful for washing in the mornings. I used to wash one day and shave the next. There was never enough water for both. The position stank abominably, and outside the little enclosure of the barricade there was excrement everywhere. Some of the militiamen habitually defecated in the trench, a disgusting thing when one had to walk round it in the darkness. But the dirt never worried me. Dirt is a thing people make too much fuss about. It is astonishing how quickly you get used to doing without a handkerchief and to eating out of the tin pannikin in which you also wash. Nor was sleeping in one's clothes any hardship after a day or two. It was, of course, impossible to take one's clothes and especially one's boots off at night. One had to be ready to turn out instantly in case of an attack. In 80 nights, I only took my clothes off 3 times, though I did occasionally manage to get them off in the daytime. It was too cold for lice as yet, but rats and mice abounded. It is often said that you don't find rats and mice in the same place, but you do when there is enough food for them. In other ways, we were not badly off. The food was good enough, and there was plenty of wine. Cigarettes were still being issued at the rate of a packet a day. Matches were issued every other day. There was even an issue of candles. They were very thin candles, like those on a Christmas cake, and were popularly supposed to have been looted from churches. Every dugout was issued daily with 3 inches of candle, which would burn for about 20 minutes. At that time it was still possible to buy candles, and I had brought several pounds of them with me. Later on, the famine of matches and candles made life a misery. You do not realize the importance of these things until you lack them. In a night alarm, for instance, when everyone in the dugout is scrambling for his rifle and treading on everybody else's face, being able to strike a light may make the difference between life and death. Every militiaman possessed a tinder lighter and several yards of yellow wick. Next to his rifle, it was his most important possession. The tinder lighters had the great advantage that they could be struck in a wind, but they would only smoulder, so that they were no use for lighting a fire. When the match famine was at its worst, our only way of producing a flame was to pull the bullet out of a cartridge and touch the cordite off with a tinder lighter. It was an extraordinary life that we were living, an extraordinary way to be at war, if you could call it war. The whole militia chafed against the inaction and clamoured constantly to know why we were not allowed to attack. But it was perfectly obvious that there would be no battle for a long time yet, unless the enemy started it. Georges Kopp, on his periodical tours of inspection, was quite frank with us. "This is not a war," he used to say. "It is a comic opera with an occasional death." As a matter of fact, the stagnation on the Aragon front had political causes of which I knew nothing at that time. But the purely military difficulties, quite apart from the lack of reserves of men, were obvious to anybody. To begin with, there was the nature of the country. The front line, ours and the fascists, lay in positions of immense natural strength, which as a rule could only be approached from one side. Provided a few trenches have been dug, such places cannot be taken by infantry, except in overwhelming numbers. In our own position, or most of those round us, a dozen men with two machine guns could have held off a battalion. Perched on the hilltops as we were, we should have made lovely marks for artillery, but there was no artillery. Sometimes I used to gaze round the landscape and long, oh how passionately, for a couple of batteries of guns. One could have destroyed the enemy positions one after another as easily as smashing nuts with a hammer. But on our side, the guns simply did not exist. The fascists did occasionally manage to bring a gun or two from Zaragoza and fire a very few shells, so few that they never even found the range, and the shells plunged harmlessly into the empty ravines. Against machine guns and without artillery, there are only three things you can do. Dig yourself in at a safe distance, 400 yards, say, advance across the open and be massacred, or make small-scale night attacks that will not alter the general situation. Practically, the alternatives are stagnation or suicide. And beyond this, there was the complete lack of war materials of every description. It needs an effort to realize how badly the militias were armed at this time. Any public school OTC in England is far more like a modern army than we were. The badness of our weapons was so astonishing that it is worth recording in detail. For this sector of the front, the entire artillery consisted of four trench mortars with 15 rounds for each gun. Of course, they were far too precious to be fired, and the mortars were kept in Alcubierre. There were machine guns at the rate of approximately 1 to 50 men. They were oldish guns, but fairly accurate up to 300 or 400 yards. Beyond this, we had only rifles, and the majority of the rifles were scrap iron. There were three types of rifle in use. The first was the long Mauser. These were seldom less than 20 years old. Their sights were about as much use as a broken speedometer, and in most of them the rifling was hopelessly corroded. About one rifle in 10 was not bad, however. Then there was the short Mauser, or mousqueton, really a cavalry weapon. These were more popular than the others because they were lighter to carry and less nuisance in a trench, also because they were comparatively new and looked efficient. Actually, they were almost useless. They were made out of reassembled parts. No bolt belonged to its rifle, and three quarters of them could be counted on to jam after five shots. There were also a few Winchester rifles. These were nice to shoot with, but they were wildly inaccurate, and as their cartridges had no clips, they could only be fired one shot at a time. Ammunition was so scarce that each man entering the line was only issued with 50 rounds, and most of it was exceedingly bad. The Spanish-made cartridges were all refills and would jam even the best rifles. The Mexican cartridges were better and were therefore reserved for the machine guns. Best of all was the German-made ammunition, but as this came only from prisoners and deserters, there was not much of it. I always kept a clip of German or Mexican ammunition in my pocket for use in an emergency. But in practice, when the emergency came, I seldom fired my rifle. I was too frightened of the beastly thing jamming, and too anxious to reserve at any rate one round that would go off. We had no tin hats, no bayonets, hardly any revolvers or pistols, and not more than one bomb between 5 or 10 men. The bomb in use at this time was a frightful object known as the FAI bomb, it having been produced by the anarchists in the early days of the war. It was on the principle of a Mills bomb, but the lever was held down not by a pin, but a piece of tape. You broke the tape and then got rid of the bomb with the utmost possible speed. It was said of these bombs that they were impartial. They killed the man they were thrown at and the man who threw them. There were several other types, even more primitive, but probably a little less dangerous. To the thrower, I mean. It was not till late March that I saw a bomb worth throwing. And apart from weapons, there was a shortage of all the minor necessities of war. We had no maps or charts, for instance. Spain has never been fully surveyed, and the only detailed maps of this area were the old military ones, which were almost all in the possession of the fascists. We had no range finders, no telescopes, no periscopes, no field glasses, except a few privately owned pairs, no flares or veery lights, no wire cutters, no armourer's tools, hardly even any cleaning materials. The Spaniards seemed never to have heard of a pull-through, and looked on in surprise when I constructed one. When you wanted your rifle cleaned, you took it to the sergeant, who possessed a long brass ramrod, which was invariably bent and therefore scratched the rifling. There was not even any gun oil. You greased your rifle with olive oil, when you could get hold of it. At different times I have greased mine with Vaseline, with cold cream, and even with bacon fat. Moreover, there were no lanterns or electric torches. At this time there was not, I believe, such a thing as an electric torch throughout the whole of our sector of the front, and you could not buy one nearer than Barcelona, and only with difficulty, even there. As time went on, and the desultory rifle fire rattled among the hills, I began to wonder with increasing scepticism whether anything would ever happen to bring a bit of life, or rather a bit of death, into this cockeyed war. It was pneumonia that we were fighting against, not against men. When the trenches are more than 500 yards apart, no one gets hit except by accident. Of course, there were casualties, but the majority of them were self-inflicted. If I remember rightly, the first 5 men I saw wounded in Spain were all wounded by our own weapons. I don't mean intentionally, but owing to accident or carelessness. Our worn-out rifles were a danger in themselves. Some of them had a nasty trick of going off if the butt was tapped on the ground. I saw a man shoot himself through the hand owing to this. And in the darkness, the raw recruits were always firing at one another. One evening, when it was barely even dusk, a sentry let fly at me from a distance of 20 yards. But he missed me by a yard. Goodness knows how many times the Spanish standard of marksmanship has saved my life. Another time, I had gone out on patrol in the mist, and had carefully warned the guard commander beforehand. But in coming back I stumbled against a bush. The startled sentry called out that the fascists were coming, and I had the pleasure of hearing the guard commander order everyone to open rapid fire in my direction. Of course I lay down and the bullets went harmlessly over me. Nothing will convince a Spaniard, at least a young Spaniard, that firearms are dangerous. Once, rather later than this, I was photographing some machine gunners with their gun, which was pointed directly towards me. "Don't fire," I said, half-jokingly, as I focused the camera. "Oh no, we won't fire." The next moment there was a frightful roar, and a stream of bullets tore past my face so close that my cheek was stung by grains of cordite. It was unintentional, but the machine gunners considered it a great joke. Yet only a few days earlier they had seen a mule driver accidentally shot by a political delegate who was playing the fool with an automatic pistol and had put 5 bullets in the mule driver's lungs. The difficult passwords which the army was using at this time were a minor source of danger. They were those tiresome double passwords in which one word has to be answered by another. Usually, they were of an elevating and revolutionary nature, such as cultura, progresso, or seremos, invencibles. And it was often impossible to get illiterate sentries to remember these highfalutin words. One night, I remember, the password was Catalunya Heroica, and a moon-faced peasant lad named Jaime Domenech approached me, greatly puzzled, and asked me to explain. Heroica. What does Heroica mean? I told him that it meant the same as Valiente. A little while later, he was stumbling up the trench in the darkness, and the sentry challenged him.
Alto! Catalunya!
Valiente!
Yelled Jaime, certain that he was saying the right thing. Bang! However, the sentry missed him. In this war, everyone always did miss everyone else, when it was humanly possible. Chapter 4. When I had been about 3 weeks in the line, a contingent of 20 or 30 men sent out from England by the ILP arrived at Alcubierre, and in order to keep the English on this front together, Williams and I were sent to join them. Our new position was at Montitrazo, several miles further west and within sight of Saragossa. The position was perched on a sort of razorback of limestone with dugouts driven horizontally into the cliff like sand martins' nests. They went into the ground for prodigious distances, and inside they were pitch dark and so low that you could not even kneel in them, let alone stand. On the peaks to the left of us there were 2 more POUM positions, one of them an object of fascination to every man in the line because there were 3 militia women there who did the cooking. These women were not exactly beautiful, but it was found necessary to put the position out of bounds to men of other companies. 500 yards to our right, there was a PSUC post at the bend of the Alcubierre Road. It was just here that the road changed hands. At night, you could watch the lamps of our supply lorries winding out from Alcubierre, and simultaneously those of the fascists coming from Saragossa. You could see Saragossa itself, a thin string of lights like the lighted portholes of a ship, 12 miles southwestward. The government troops had gazed at it from that distance since August 1936, and they are gazing at it still. There were about 30 of ourselves, including 1 Spaniard, Ramon, Williams's brother-in-law, and there were 12 Spanish machine gunners. Apart from the 1 or 2 inevitable nuisances, for as everyone knows war attracts riffraff, the English were an exceptionally good crowd both physically and mentally. Perhaps the best of the bunch was Bob Smiley, the grandson of the famous miners' leader, who afterwards died such an evil and meaningless death in Valencia. It says a lot for the Spanish character that the English and the Spaniards always got on well together in spite of the language difficulty. All Spaniards, we discovered, knew 2 English expressions. One was, "Okay, baby." The other was a word used by the Barcelona whores in their dealings with English sailors, and I am afraid the compositors would not print it. Once again, there was nothing happening all along the line. Only the random crack of bullets, and very rarely the crash of a fascist mortar that sent everyone running to the top trench to see which hill the shells were bursting on. The enemy was somewhat closer to us here, perhaps 300 or 400 yards away. Their nearest position was exactly opposite ours, with a machine gun nest whose loopholes constantly tempted one to waste cartridges. The fascists seldom bothered with rifle shots, but sent bursts of accurate machine gun fire at anyone who exposed himself. Nevertheless, it was 10 days or more before we had our first casualty. The troops opposite us were Spaniards, but according to the deserters there were a few German NCOs among them. At some time in the past there had also been Moors there. Poor devils, how they must have felt the cold. For out in no man's land there was a dead Moor who was one of the sights of the locality. A mile or two to the left of us the line ceased to be continuous, and there was a tract of country, lower lying and thickly wooded, which belonged neither to the fascists nor ourselves. Both we and they used to make daylight patrols there. It was not bad fun in a boy scoutish way, though I never saw a fascist patrol nearer than several hundred yards. By a lot of crawling on your belly, you could work your way partly through the fascist lines, and could even see the farmhouse flying the monarchist flag, which was the local fascist headquarters. Occasionally we gave it a rifle volley, and then slipped into cover before the machine guns could locate us. I hope we broke a few windows, but it was a good 800 meters away, and with our rifles you could not make sure of hitting even a house at that range. The weather was mostly clear and cold, sometimes sunny at midday, but always cold. Here and there in the soil of the hillsides, you found the green beaks of wild crocuses or irises poking through. Evidently spring was coming, but coming very slowly. The nights were colder than ever. Coming off guard in the small hours, we used to rake together what was left of the cookhouse fire, and then stand in the red-hot embers. It was bad for your boots, but it was very good for your feet. But there were mornings when the sight of the dawn among the mountaintops made it almost worthwhile to be out of bed at godless hours. I hate mountains, even from a spectacular point of view. But sometimes, the dawn breaking behind the hilltops in our rear, the first narrow streaks of gold like swords slitting the darkness, and then the growing light and the seas of carmine cloud stretching away into inconceivable distances, were worth watching, even when you had been up all night, when your legs were numb from the knees down, and you were sullenly reflecting that there was no hope of food for another 3 hours. I saw the dawn oftener during this campaign than during the rest of my life put together, or during the part that is to come, I hope. We were short-handed here, which meant longer guards and more fatigues. I was beginning to suffer a little from the lack of sleep, which is inevitable even in the quietest kind of war. Apart from guard duties and patrols, there were constant night alarms and stand-tos, and in any case you can't sleep properly in a beastly hole in the ground with your feet aching with the cold. In my first 3 or 4 months in the line, I do not suppose I had more than a dozen periods of 24 hours that were completely without sleep. On the other hand, I certainly did not have a dozen nights of full sleep. 20 or 30 hours sleep in a week was quite a normal amount. The effects of this were not so bad as might be expected. One grew very stupid, and the job of climbing up and down the hills grew harder instead of easier, but one felt well, and one was constantly hungry. Heavens, how hungry! All food seemed good, even the eternal haricot beans which everyone in Spain finally learned to hate the sight of. Our water, what there was of it, came from miles away, on the backs of mules or little persecuted donkeys. For some reason, the Aragon peasants treated their mules well, but their donkeys abominably. If a donkey refused to go, it was quite usual to kick him in the testicles. The issue of candles had ceased, and matches were running short. The Spaniards taught us how to make olive oil lamps out of a condensed milk tin, a cartridge clip, and a bit of rag. When you had any olive oil, which was not often, these things would burn with a smoky flicker about a quarter candle power, just enough to find your rifle by. There seemed no hope of any real fighting. When we left Monte Passero, I had counted my cartridges and found that in nearly 3 weeks I had fired just 3 shots at the enemy. They say it takes 1,000 bullets to kill a man, and at this rate it would be 20 years before I killed my first fascist. At Monte Trazzo the lines were closer and one fired oftener, but I'm reasonably certain that I never hit anyone. As a matter of fact, on this front, and at this period of the war, the real weapon was not the rifle, but the megaphone. Being unable to kill your enemy, you shouted at him instead. This method of warfare is so extraordinary that it needs explaining. Wherever the lines were within hailing distance of one another, there was always a good deal of shouting from trench to trench, from ourselves,
Fascistas, Maracones,
from the fascists, Viva España, Viva Franco. Or when they knew that there were English opposite them, Go home, you English. We don't want foreigners here. On the government side, in the party militias, the shouting of propaganda to undermine the enemy morale had been developed into a regular technique. In every suitable position, men, usually machine gunners, were told off for shouting duty and provided with megaphones. Generally, they shouted a set piece, full of revolutionary sentiments which explained to the fascist soldiers that they were merely the hirelings of international capitalism, that they were fighting against their own class, etc., etc., and urged them to come over to our side. This was repeated over and over by relays of men. Sometimes it continued almost the whole night. There is very little doubt that it had its effect. Everyone agreed that the trickle of fascist deserters was partly caused by it. If one comes to think of it, when some poor devil of a sentry, very likely a socialist or anarchist trade union member, who has been conscripted against his will, is freezing at his post, the slogan, "Don't fight against your own class," ringing again and again through the darkness, is bound to make an impression on him. It might just make the difference between deserting and not deserting. Of course, such a proceeding does not fit in with the English conception of war. I admit I was amazed and scandalized when I first saw it done. The idea of trying to convert your enemy instead of shooting him. I now think that from any point of view it was a legitimate maneuver. In ordinary trench warfare, when there is no artillery, it is extremely difficult to inflict casualties on the enemy without receiving an equal number yourself. If you can immobilize a certain number of men by making them desert, so much the better. Deserters are actually more useful to you than corpses, because they can give information. But at the beginning, it dismayed all of us. It made us feel that the Spaniards were not taking this war of theirs sufficiently seriously. The man who did the shouting at the PSUC post down on our right was an artist at the job. Sometimes, instead of shouting revolutionary slogans, he simply told the fascists how much better we were fed than they were. His account of the government rations was apt to be a little imaginative. "Buttered toast," you could hear his voice echoing across the lonely valley. "We're just sitting down to buttered toast over here. Lovely slices of buttered toast." I do not doubt that, like the rest of us, he had not seen butter for weeks or months past. But in the icy night, the news of buttered toast probably set many a fascist mouth watering. It even made mine water, though I knew he was lying. One day in February, we saw a fascist aeroplane approaching. As usual, a machine gun was dragged into the open and its barrel cocked up, and everyone lay on his back to get a good aim. Our isolated positions were not worth bombing, and as a rule, the few fascist aeroplanes that passed our way circled round to avoid machine gun fire. This time the aeroplane came straight over, too high up to be worth shooting at, and out of it came tumbling not bombs, but white, glittering things that turned over and over in the air. A few fluttered down into the position. They were copies of a fascist newspaper, the Heraldo de Aragon, announcing the fall of Malaga. That night the fascists made a sort of abortive attack. I was just getting down into kip, half dead with sleep, when there was a heavy stream of bullets overhead and someone shouted into the dugout, "They're attacking!" I grabbed my rifle and slithered up to my post, which was at the top of the position beside the machine gun. There was utter darkness and diabolical noise. The fire of, I think, 5 machine guns was pouring upon us, and there was a series of heavy crashes caused by the fascists flinging bombs over their own parapet in the most idiotic manner. It was intensely dark. Down in the valley to the left of us, I could see the greenish flash of rifles where a small party of fascists, probably a patrol, were chipping in. The bullets were flying round us in the darkness. Crack, zip, crack. A few shells came whistling over, but they fell nowhere near us, and as usual in this war, most of them failed to explode. I had a bad moment when yet another machine gun opened fire from the hilltop in our rear. Actually a gun that had been brought up to support us, but at the time it looked as though we were surrounded. Presently, our own machine gun jammed, as it always did jam with those vile cartridges, and the ramrod was lost in the impenetrable darkness. Apparently there was nothing that one could do except stand still and be shot at. The Spanish machine gunners disdained to take cover, in fact exposed themselves deliberately, so I had to do likewise. Petty though it was, the whole experience was very interesting. It was the first time that I'd been properly speaking under fire, and to my humiliation, I found that I was horribly frightened. You always, I notice, feel the same when you are under heavy fire. Not so much afraid of being hit as afraid because you don't know where you will be hit. You are wondering all the while just where the bullet will nip you, and it gives your whole body a most unpleasant sensitiveness. After an hour or two, the firing slowed down and died away. Meanwhile, we had had only one casualty. The fascists had advanced a couple of machine guns into no man's land, but they had kept at a safe distance and made no attempt to storm our parapet. They were, in fact, not attacking, merely wasting cartridges and making a cheerful noise to celebrate the fall of Malaga. The chief importance of the affair was that it taught me to read the war news in the papers with a more disbelieving eye. A day or two later, the newspapers and the radio published reports of a tremendous attack with cavalry and tanks up a perpendicular hillside, which had been beaten off by the heroic English. When the fascists told us that Malaga had fallen, we set it down as a lie. But next day, there were more convincing rumours, and it must have been a day or two later that it was admitted officially. By degrees, the whole disgraceful story leaked out, how the town had been evacuated without firing a shot, and how the fury of the Italians had fallen not upon the troops who were gone, but upon the wretched civilian population, some of whom were pursued and machine-gunned for 100 miles. The news sent a sort of chill all along the line, for whatever the truth may have been, every man in the militia believed that the loss of Malaga was due to treachery. It was the first talk I had heard of treachery or divided aims. It set up in my mind the first vague doubt about this war in which hitherto the rights and wrongs had seemed so beautifully simple. In mid-February, we left Montetrazzo and were sent, together with all the POUM troops in this sector, to make a part of the army besieging Huesca. It was a 50-mile lorry journey across the wintry plain, where the clipped vines were not yet budding, and the blades of the winter barley were just poking through the lumpy soil. 4 kilometres from our new trenches, Huesca glittered small and clear like a city of dolls' houses. Months earlier, when Sietamo was taken, the general commanding the government troops had said gaily, "Tomorrow we'll have coffee in Huesca." It turned out that he was mistaken. There had been bloody attacks, but the town did not fall. And "tomorrow we'll have coffee in Huesca" had become a standing joke throughout the army. If I ever go back to Spain, I shall make a point of having a cup of coffee in Huesca. Chapter 5. On the eastern side of Huesca, until late March, nothing happened. Almost literally, nothing. We were 1,200 metres from the enemy. When the fascists were driven back into Huesca, the Republican Army troops who held this part of the line had not been overzealous in their advance, so that the line formed a kind of pocket. Later it would have to be advanced, a ticklish job under fire, but for the present the enemy might as well have been non-existent. Our sole preoccupation was keeping warm and getting enough to eat. Meanwhile, the daily, more particularly nightly round, the common task. Sentry go, patrols, digging, mud, rain, shrieking winds, and occasional snow. It was not till well into April that the nights grew noticeably warmer. Up here, on the plateau, the March days were mostly like an English March, with bright blue skies and nagging winds. The winter barley was a foot high. Crimson buds were forming on the cherry trees. The line here ran through deserted orchards and vegetable gardens. And if you searched the ditches, you could find violets and a kind of wild hyacinth, like a poor specimen of a bluebell. Immediately behind the line, there ran a wonderful green bubbling stream, the first transparent water I had seen since coming to the front. One day I set my teeth and crawled into the river to have my first bath in 6 weeks. It was what you might call a brief bath, for the water was mainly snow water and not much above freezing point. Meanwhile, nothing happened. Nothing ever happened. The English had got into the habit of saying that this wasn't a war, it was a bloody pantomime. We were hardly under direct fire from the fascists. The only danger was from stray bullets, which, as the lines curved forward on either side, came from several directions. All the casualties at this time were from strays. Arthur Clinton got a mysterious bullet that smashed his left shoulder and disabled his arm permanently, I'm afraid. There was a little shell fire, but it was extraordinarily ineffectual. The scream and crash of the shells was actually looked upon as a mild diversion. The fascists never dropped their shells on our parapet. A few hundred yards behind us there was a country house called La Granja, with big farm buildings which was used as a store, headquarters and cookhouse for this sector of the line. It was this that the fascist gunners were trying for, but they were 5 or 6 kilometres away, and they never aimed well enough to do more than smash the windows and chip the walls. You were only in danger if you happened to be coming up the road when the firing started, and the shells plunged into the fields on either side of you. One learned almost immediately the mysterious art of knowing by the sound of a shell how close it will fall. The shells the fascists were firing at this period were wretchedly bad. Although they were 150 millimetres, they only made a crater about 6 feet wide, by 4 deep, and at least 1 in 4 failed to explode. There were the usual romantic tales of sabotage in the fascist factories, and unexploded shells in which instead of the charge, there was found a scrap of paper saying Red Front. But I never saw one. The truth was that the shells were hopelessly old. Someone picked up a brass fuse cap stamped with the date, and it was 1917. The fascist guns were of the same make and calibre as our own, and the unexploded shells were often reconditioned and fired back. There was said to be one old shell with a nickname of its own which travelled daily to and fro, never exploding. At night, small patrols used to be sent into no man's land to lie in ditches near the fascist lines and listen for sounds, bugle calls, motor horns and so forth, that indicated activity in Huesca. There was a constant come-and-go of fascist troops, and their numbers could be checked to some extent from listeners' reports. We always had special orders to report the ringing of church bells. It seemed that the fascists always heard mass before going into action. In among the fields and orchards there were deserted mud-walled huts, which it was safe to explore with a lighted match when you had plugged up the windows. Sometimes you came on valuable pieces of loot, such as a hatchet or a fascist water bottle, better than ours and greatly sought after. You could explore in the daytime as well, but mostly it had to be done crawling on all fours. It was queer to creep about in those empty, fertile fields, where everything had been arrested just at the harvest moment. Last year's crops had never been touched. The unpruned vines were snaking across the ground. The cobs on the standing maize had gone as hard as stone. The mangels and sugar beets were hypertrophied into huge woody lumps. How the peasants must have cursed both armies. Sometimes parties of men went spud-gathering in no man's land. About a mile to the right of us, where the lines were closer together, there was a patch of potatoes that was frequented both by the fascists and ourselves. We went there in the daytime, they only at night, as it was commanded by our machine guns. One night, to our annoyance, they turned out en masse and cleared up the whole patch. We discovered another patch further on, where there was practically no cover, and you had to lift the potatoes lying on your belly, a fatiguing job. If their machine gunners spotted you, you had to flatten yourself out like a rat when it squirms under a door, with the bullets cutting up the clods a few yards behind you. It seemed worth it at the time. Potatoes were getting very scarce. If you got a sackful, you could take them down to the cookhouse and swap them for a water bottle full of coffee. And still, nothing happened. Nothing ever looked like happening. When are we going to attack? Why don't we attack? Were the questions you heard night and day from Spaniard and Englishman alike. When you think what fighting means, it is queer that soldiers want to fight. And yet undoubtedly they do. In stationary warfare, there are three things that all soldiers long for: a battle, more cigarettes, and a week's leave. We were somewhat better armed now than before. Each man had 150 rounds of ammunition instead of 50, and by degrees we were being issued with bayonets, steel helmets, and a few bombs. There were constant rumours of forthcoming battles, which I have since thought were deliberately circulated to keep up the spirits of the troops. It did not need much military knowledge to see that there would be no major action on this side of Wesker, at any rate for the time being. The strategic point was the road to Jaca, over on the other side. Later, when the anarchists made their attacks on the Jaca road, our job was to make holding attacks and force the fascists to divert troops from the other side. During all this time, about 6 weeks, there was only one action on our part of the front. This was when our shock troopers attacked the Manicomio, a disused lunatic asylum which the fascists had converted into a fortress. There were several hundred refugee Germans serving with the POUM. They were organized in a special battalion called the Bataillon de Choque, and from a military point of view, they were on quite a different level from the rest of the militia. Indeed, were more like soldiers than anyone I saw in Spain, except the assault guards and some of the international column. The attack was mucked up, as usual. How many operations in this war on the government side were not mucked up, I wonder? The shock troops took the Manicomio by storm, but the troops of I forget which militia, who were to support them by seizing the neighbouring hill that commanded the Manicomio, were badly let down. The captain who led them was one of those regular army officers of doubtful loyalty whom the government persisted in employing. Either from fright or treachery, he warned the fascists by flinging a bomb when they were 200 yards away. I'm glad to say his men shot him dead on the spot. But the surprise attack was no surprise, and the militiamen were mown down by heavy fire and driven off the hill, and at nightfall the shock troops had to abandon the Manicomio. Through the night the ambulances filed down the abominable road to Sietamo, killing the badly wounded with their joltings. All of us were lousy by this time. Though still cold, it was warm enough for that. I have had a big experience of body vermin of various kinds, and for sheer beastliness, the louse beats everything I have encountered. Other insects, mosquitoes, for instance, make you suffer more, but at least they aren't resident vermin. The human louse somewhat resembles a tiny lobster, and he lives, chiefly, in your trousers. Short of burning all your clothes, there is no known way of getting rid of him. Down the seams of your trousers he lays his glittering white eggs, like tiny grains of rice, which hatch out and breed families of their own at horrible speed. I think the pacifists might find it helpful to illustrate their pamphlets with enlarged photographs of lice. Glory of war, indeed. In war, all soldiers are lousy, at least when it is warm enough. The men who fought at Verdun, at Waterloo, at Flodden, at Senlac, at Thermopylae, every one of them had lice crawling over his testicles. We kept the brutes down to some extent by burning out the eggs and by bathing as often as we could face it. Nothing short of lice could have driven me into that ice-cold river. Everything was running short. Boots, clothes, tobacco, soap, candles, matches, olive oil. Our uniforms were dropping to pieces, and many of the men had no boots, only rope-soled sandals. You came on piles of worn-out boots everywhere. Once, we kept a dugout fire burning for 2 days, mainly with boots, which are not bad fuel. By this time, my wife was in Barcelona, and used to send me tea, chocolate, and even cigars, when such things were procurable. But even in Barcelona, everything was running short, especially tobacco. The tea was a godsend, though we had no milk and seldom any sugar. Parcels were constantly being sent from England to men in the contingent, but they never arrived. Food, clothes, cigarettes. Everything was either refused by the post office or seized in France. Curiously enough, the only firm that succeeded in sending packets of tea, even on one memorable occasion a tin of biscuits, to my wife, was the Army and Navy stores. Poor old Army and Navy. They did their duty nobly, but perhaps they might have felt happier if the stuff had been going to Franco's side of the barricade. The shortage of tobacco was the worst of all. At the beginning, we'd been issued with a packet of cigarettes a day. Then it got down to 8 cigarettes a day, then to 5. Finally, there were 10 deadly days when there was no issue of tobacco at all. For the first time in Spain, I saw something that you see every day in London. People picking up fag ends. Towards the end of March, I got a poisoned hand that had to be lanced and put in a sling. I had to go into hospital, but it was not worth sending me to Sietamo for such a petty injury, so I stayed in the so-called hospital at Monflorite, which was merely a casualty clearing station. I was there 10 days, part of the time in bed. The practicantes, hospital assistants, stole practically every valuable object I possessed, including my camera and all my photographs. At the front, everyone stole. It was the inevitable effect of shortage, but the hospital people were always the worst. Later, in the hospital at Barcelona, an American who had come to join the international column on a ship that was torpedoed by an Italian submarine told me how he was carried ashore wounded and how, even as they lifted him into the ambulance, the stretcher-bearers pinched his wristwatch. While my arm was in the sling, I spent several blissful days wandering about the countryside. Monflorite was the usual huddle of mud and stone houses, with narrow, tortuous alleys that had been churned by lorries till they looked like the craters of the moon. The church had been badly knocked about, but was used as a military store. In the whole neighbourhood there were only 2 farmhouses of any size, Torre Lorenzo and Torre Fabian, and only 2 really large buildings, obviously the houses of the landowners who had once lorded it over the countryside. You could see their wealth reflected in the miserable huts of the peasants. Just behind the river, close to the front line, there was an enormous flour mill with a country house attached to it. It seemed shameful to see the huge, costly machines, rusting useless, and the wooden flower chutes, torn down for firewood. Later on, to get firewood for the troops further back, parties of men were sent in lorries to wreck the place systematically. They used to smash the floorboards of a room by bursting a hand grenade in it. La Granja, our store and cookhouse, had possibly at one time been a convent. It had huge courtyards and outhouses, covering an acre or more, with stabling for 30 or 40 horses. The country houses in that part of Spain are of no interest architecturally, but their farm buildings of lime-washed stone with round arches and magnificent roof beams are noble places, built on a plan that has probably not altered for centuries. Sometimes it gave you a sneaking sympathy with the fascist ex-owners to see the way the militia treated the buildings they had seized. In La Granja, every room that was not in use had been turned into a latrine, a frightful shambles of smashed furniture and excrement. The little church that adjoined it, its walls perforated by shell holes, had its floor inches deep in dung. In the great courtyard where the cooks ladled out the rations, the litter of rusty tins, mud, mule dung and decaying food was revolting. It gave point to the old army song, "There are rats, rats, rats as big as cats in the quartermaster's store." The ones at La Granja itself really were as big as cats, or nearly. Great, bloated brutes that waddled over the beds of muck, too impudent even to run away unless you shot at them. Spring was really here at last. The blue in the sky was softer. The air grew suddenly balmy. The frogs were mating noisily in the ditches. Round the drinking pool that served for the village mules, I found exquisite green frogs the size of a penny, so brilliant that the young grass looked dull beside them. Peasant lads went out with buckets hunting for snails, which they roasted alive on sheets of tin. As soon as the weather improved, the peasants had turned out for the spring ploughing. It is typical of the utter vagueness in which the Spanish agrarian revolution is wrapped that I could not even discover for certain whether the land here was collectivized or whether the peasants had simply divided it up among themselves. I fancied that in theory it was collectivized, this being POUM and anarchist territory. At any rate, the landowners were gone. The fields were being cultivated, and people seemed satisfied. The friendliness of the peasants towards ourselves never ceased to astonish me. To some of the older ones, the war must have seemed meaningless. Visibly, it produced a shortage of everything, and a dismal, dull life for everybody, and at the best of times, peasants hate having troops quartered upon them. Yet they were invariably friendly. I suppose reflecting that, however intolerable we might be in other ways, we did stand between them and their one-time landlords. Civil war is a queer thing. Huesca was not 5 miles away. It was these people's market town. All of them had relatives there. Every week of their lives they had gone there to sell their poultry and vegetables. And now, for 8 months, an impenetrable barrier of barbed wire and machine guns had lain between. Occasionally it slipped their memory. Once I was talking to an old woman who was carrying one of those tiny iron lamps in which the Spaniards burn olive oil. "Where can I buy a lamp like that?" I said. "In Huesca," she said without thinking. And then we both laughed. The village girls were splendid, vivid creatures with coal-black hair, a swinging walk, and a straightforward man-to-man demeanour which was probably a byproduct of the revolution. Men in ragged blue shirts and black corduroy breeches, with broad-brimmed straw hats, were ploughing the fields behind teams of mules with rhythmically flopping ears. Their ploughs were wretched things, only stirring the soil, not cutting anything we should regard as a furrow. All the agricultural implements were pitifully antiquated, everything being governed by the expensiveness of metal. A broken ploughshare, for instance, was patched, and then patched again, to till sometimes it was mainly patches. Rakes and pitchforks were made of wood. Spades, among a people who seldom possessed boots, were unknown. They did their digging with a clumsy hoe like those used in India.